Now I would like to introduce the good friend of mine, Dr. Naba, who, by the way, claimed that we were drinking together at Istanbul. That's not true. We were drinking together in Antalya. That means that he was completely drunk. Sorry about that. I will not mention anything to your wife. Now, Dr. Naba is a professor of surgery at the University of Southern California, advised chair of surgery, the program director for the surgical residency. And as you've already heard, he will talk to us about injuries of the subclavian artery. Thank you.
And is that projecting? Yeah, I think it's good. All right. Well, thank you again for staying. This will be the last lecture, and the last topic, as everyone has mentioned, is going to be the subclavian. Now, this is really a great topic. People that come in with injuries to that periclavicular area. This is, no matter where you work, a very uncommon injury, and no matter how busy your trauma center is, you're going to have relatively limited clinical experience. Access, like many places, is the critical problem that we encounter, and that, when you put that together with the high mortality in these cases, makes it a really good thing to review every now and then. So I'm going to try to keep this very practical, and over the next 14 or 15 minutes or so, I'm going to go over the diagnosis and the treatment, and really the goal is, the next time you have a patient with a hole in the periclavicular area, we're going to make sure that you have a good approach to how to work this patient up, and then how to access that vessel. So if we start off with diagnosis, patient comes in and they've got some periclavicular holes. I think, like every single speaker has mentioned, we're going to start off with the physical examination. This is going to guide you as to where you need to go next. And really, you're going to ask yourself, do they have hard signs, soft signs, or no signs of vascular injury? Now, if they have hard signs, and like for any extremity injury, that would be active arterial bleeding, a big hematoma in that area, or no pulse, that would be a classic hard sign. The subclavian's a little bit different from the remainder of the solid extremity injuries in that the other thing that can happen is that bleeding can come outwards, you can get truncation in the vessel so there's no flow and you lose the pulse, or the bleeding can go inwards. So if you have a hole in the periclavicular area and you get a chest x-ray and you see that there's a massive hemothorax, there's a very high likelihood when you go in there, you scoop that blood out, that, like in this case, that bleeding was very high volume, if it is very high volume, from a subclavian injury. These can bleed a tremendous amount over a relatively short period of time into the thoracic cavity. So unlike the rest of the solid organ or solid extremity injuries, we will look at arterial bleeding, we'll look at hematomas, no pulse, or a hemothorax as a hard sign of injury, and these patients can go directly to the operating room. Now, if you have no signs of any vascular injury, this is relatively rare, but these patients can be observed, which really leaves the bulk of the patients that have soft signs. And really, in 2018, I think the diagnostic imaging of choice is going to be a CT angio. We're looking for patients that have minor oozing, a small hematoma, a little bit of a hemothorax, or an altered BBI. If you see any of these patients can go to CT angio. There's a lot of benefits to using CT angio as our initial diagnostic modality for screening. Everybody knows these. And really, as a surgeon, the picture relevance to what we're going to find in the operating room is really quite good. You can see that here, this is a very proximal injury. And when you look closely at the architecture of this injury, on the planar films and on the 3D reconstructions, you can see that they really mimic very nicely what it is that you're going to expect to see in the operating room. So I think from a diagnostic standpoint, really it's based off of our physical examination. If they have hard signs of vascular injury, they should go to the operating room. If they have no signs, you can observe them. And for the majority of patients that have soft signs, they can go to CT angio. Now, what about treatment? Well, for the treatment, I think for any vascular injury, we should think about hemorrhage control first. The mainstay of treatment for the subclavian injuries, which is open access, and then, as Dr. Maddox mentioned, there's been a move towards, especially for the subclavian in this field, the use of endovascular approaches. So we'll just cover that with a couple of slides as well. So what about hemorrhage control? Well, as you know, externally, subclavian injuries can bleed a lot, a tremendous amount. And our first move, of course, is to put a finger on it and to control that bleeding manually. Now, if you're working in a more rural setting where you don't have hands to leave in there and you need to transport the patient, or in this situation, We're up in the operating room now. We need to get everyone out of there so we can get this patient ready so that we can operate on it. On the patient, a Foley catheter is, as was mentioned by several of the speakers, an excellent way to gain temporary control. Now this, I'll show you where the injury is in just a second, but you can see that it's deep down in there, but this fills into the space, the balloon gets inflated with some saline, and it very nicely will stop the bleeding temporarily, enough for you to be able to move on and do other things. And in this patient, you can see that the arrow where it says balloon, that's the track that the Foley catheter was taking, and the injury's already been fixed. It was a subclavian vein injury, very deep down and rather proximal, but it was able to hold that bleeding off until we got the chest open. We were able to repair the subclavian vein and move on with this patient. Now, the interesting thing about the subclavian and the use of balloons is that this is the one spot, unlike many other areas in the body, where when you put that balloon in, it might actually slip right into the chest. So here's a six-year-old boy, very sad story. His mom stabbed him, and he bled into the chest cavity. So he was brought here resting. We opened his chest, massive hemothorax. And so the first thing when we looked up is you can see a little bit, he was arrested, so there wasn't much flow, but you can see blood trickling down, and we thought that it was likely due to a subclavian vessel injury. That first balloon just slipped into the chest, so we blew it up, and we pulled that balloon back so that the bleeding wouldn't continue into the chest, and then we just put a second balloon in, into the soft tissues, and expanded that balloon. And that was able to not only stop the bleeding coming externally, but it also stopped the bleeding from going internally as well. And in fact, after this, we actually got his heart back and brought him to CT scan and found that the artery was intact, and it was a venous injury. And by 24 hours, when we took him back, we released that balloon slowly, and it was enough, just with the balloon tamponade, to seal off that vein. So we didn't take the clavicle down, as I'm going to show you in just a second. And the repeat CT scan done at a week showed that the venous channel was open in that area. So it's a very effective way of temporarily holding off that bleeding, and he's doing well. He's in the care of foster parents now. And so this is a very nice way to temporize bleeding. Now, once you've got that hemorrhage control done, really it comes down to open access. And I think for everybody in this room, when you see that subclavian injury, you see that gunshot wound in that area that's bleeding, or you see it on a CAT scan, there's a little moment of fear, because the reality is to access these beautiful vessels that are sitting there, you have to get through the bone, and that clavicle is sitting right in the way. So I'll tell you that the very first step is to ensure that you can move that clavicle out of the way, and once you do that, that will open the window up into the vessels that you need to approach. So I think, you know, to keep everything simple, I'm a simplistic guy. I think all my partners at LA County are very simplistic. One incision for any subclavian injury, it's going to be a periclavicular incision over the clavicle. The right side is the same as the left side. Distally, if it's a distal injury, you can extend it all the way down the arm. And as everybody has mentioned, if you need to go proximal, you need to do that sternotomy. And really, for the routine average case, for the routine average surgeon, there's really no role for these trapdoors or combined thoracotomy type incisions. Clavicular incision, right side and left side. If you need proximal control, you can do a sternotomy. Distally, you just run that incision down the arm. Now, I'll show you step by step in a cadaver and then in a real patient what that looks like. So again, a nice incision over the periclavicular area, and you really want to get all those soft tissues off the clavicle itself so that you can get yourself all the way around that bone. You can use whatever you want to get across that clavicle. A giggly will work nicely, and you want to separate that clavicle from the sternum. And once you do that, in most patients, maybe not the bulkiest muscular males, but in virtually all patients, that can then be mobilized out of the way, and a medical student or somebody can hold that out of the way for you, exposing the bed where the subclavian vessels are going to lie. And again, you can see in this photo that if you want more proximal control, that sternotomy opens everything up proximally. And if you want more distal control, you can run that incision as far down as you need to. And with that done, it really gives you complete and beautiful exposure to all of those vessels on both the left side, as in this case, as well as on the right side. Now, do we need to bring that clavicle back together? If it's a damage control situation and you really, and it was a big male with a lot of musculature and you have to actually remove the clavicle, I think it's fine. It's ideal if you can bring it back together, but I think there is some good data. This is a study that Steve Shackford's group did, looking specifically at the impact of a complete clavicular resection, and they had really nice follow-up. So people often cite this study. 4.8 years, and then at 9.4 years, they ran a bunch of functional tests on these folks. And You know, the reality is, if you look at these very specific scoring systems, you will be able to detect deficit. But provided they're not pitching for the game tonight and they're just the average person, the reality is this translates to a minimal practical deficit. And overall, when you ask them about their own perception of any deficits, their health markers and their functional markers are all rated as normal. So I think for the average person, if you can get the clavicle back, awesome, but if you can't, it's okay not to do that. I think for the average female patient, the cosmesis also to get that scoop or that little shallow in your neck, it's nice to be able to put the clavicle back. But if you have to remove it and there's no time because it's a damage control situation, I think it's perfectly fine to not bring that bone back. Okay, so if we can go through in a real live patient, this patient that was shot twice in the neck, you can see that we started off with a clavicular incision, so it's already started to go down. We thought it was a little bit of a distal injury when we tracked the holes and the bullets, but of course, we got all the bone freed up all the way around so that we were able to then bring a Gigli in and remove it off of the sternum. As soon as we entered into what we thought was going to be the hematoma, we found that, in fact, it was a very proximal injury. So in these situations, again, it's simply a matter of applying a little bit of pressure and knowing that all you have to then do is open that sternum to get yourself some proximal control. And once you do that, that will then open up all of the proximal channels. You can get control of those very nicely from this while holding pressure. And that will then allow you to then go in and really unbury those vessels and reconstruct them as required. Now, when we talk about the reconstruction for the subclavian vessels, ideally, of course, we're going to be trying, like we do everywhere, to get reverse saphenous vein graft, but the reality is, for all of the subclavian level vessels, we just finished pulling our subclavian artery injuries, and the vast majority are done using polytetrafluoroethylene or Gore-Tex. So I think in reality, you need to have that ready to go. As far as the damage control situation, again, just like all of the anatomical areas that we've tackled, if you don't have time to do the definitive reconstruction, shunting is the way to go. And for any complex venous injuries, I think that ligation, again, has been mentioned in this area, would be the way to go. Now, like all trauma surgeons, I think if it's a solid extremity and we're very comfortable getting in there quickly, the whole proximal distal control versus diving right into the hematoma, as controversial as it is, I think for most of us, we will go right in at the injury. But I will tell you that this is the one spot that it does take some time to access that vasculature, no matter how good you are, no matter how many of these you've done. So I think remembering that in this situation, proximal control may be the better part of valor is important. Here's a case from last week, or maybe it was the week before. I see Zach there, one of our fellows. I did this with him last week. Man falls off of a roof onto a fence. It's a blunt injury. It's stable, no or minimal hemothorax. And we have a CAT scan that tells us that this is going to be a very proximal right subclavian injury. So in that case, we know that if we dive right in and do that clavicular incision, we're going to end up trying to hold pressure. It's going to be bleeding, and then we got to open the sternum. So if you know that ahead of time, I think in this situation, because of the time that it takes, it is well worth getting that proximal control ahead of time by opening the sternum. So in this situation, Zach very nicely took down the sternum, got it all cleaned up. We actually skeletonized that clavicle, so that was all ready to go. And once everything was open, then we tackled the bone and got that out of the way. And again, as you can see here, it is a very proximal injury, just like the CAT scan showed us it would be. And it was very helpful for us to have done that sternotomy ahead of time. That then allowed us to gain proximal control of the vessel. And once you do that, it really does look much cleaner and much more palatable and easy to fix. We got the proximal and the distal end of that vessel all out and ready to reconstruct. And we put our PTFE in place. Now, that's the open access, and I think that is the mainstay of treatment, and it's what I do, it's what all of my partners do for subclavian artery injuries for the vast majority of the cases that we see. I will say, though, that of all the places in the body, this is one spot where the endovascular treatment may be making a push in. And there are several case series that are out there now. This is one of the first ones that came out. We always cite it. It comes from Ken Maddox and his group at Ben Taub. And it's interesting to note that this is one of the first papers that came out looking at this. This is 2010 now that we're looking at. And in all of their subclavian arteries, you can see that 60% of those that survived, even at Ben Taub, a notoriously open, heavy vascular group, 60% of their survivors underwent endovascular treatment. When you look at the collated literature, a paper actually came out this year in 2018, 73 studies, 142 patients, there was 147 stents that were put in. Trauma, of course, was the most common reason why a stent went in. Although they didn't have a very good comparator group, so it's very hard to put this into context, even if you look at the pure numbers, 15.5% complication rate and an 8.5% reintervention rate, it's pretty darn good. So I think the take-home message of the collated literature up to date is that this is a feasible thing for these difficult injuries. However, more data will be required. And how does this work? Here's a patient. We rarely do this, but every now and then, this is a patient that I had 2.5, maybe 3 years ago. You can see that there's a gunshot wound to her neck. And again, a very stable injury, very little hematoma in the area. It's very contained. And you can see here on the angio, it's a very nice injury with enough of a landing spot for a stent to go in. Here's another view of it, which makes it a little bit clearer. And the IR folks were able to stent that for us, and she's lost to follow-up now, but her last visit was at almost 2 years, and at that time, she had a very normal vascular exam in her right arm, and the function was excellent. So I think this is definitely has some potential in the non-bleeding, non-urgent case. So if I could summarize everything in two questions, I would say that really physical examination is the key initial step when any vascular injury patient comes in, and that would include a periclavicular injury of any sort. If they have active bleeding externally, a hematoma that's worrisome, they're pulseless, or they have a hemothorax, those are hard signs of injury, and those patients can go directly to the operating room. If they have soft signs, a CT angiogram is probably the ideal screening modality to help you decide what you're going to do for that patient. And really, if they're bleeding, the first thing that you want to do is to get control of that bleeding with manual pressure. And if you need to free up your hands, I think a balloon is very effective in this area. And in my last slide, I would say that, you know, the mainstay of treatment still in 2018, I think, is an open repair. The one thing to remember, if you remember one thing, is that that moving of the clavicle is the initial step that you have to do, and that applies to the right side or the left side. If it's a proximal injury or you need proximal control, that's going to mean a sternotomy, and if it's a more distal injury, you can run that incision all the way down the arm. If the subclavian artery is injured and the patient's in extremis and it's a damage control situation, shunting will be the way to go. If it's a subclavian vein injury and it's complicated, it's a complex injury, or they're unstable, ligation works. And I think that as we work into the future, endovascular solutions are definitely going to be on the map and something that we should be looking out for. So I think I'm going to end there. We have a couple of minutes for questions if our speakers can come up here. And if anyone's got a question, please move to one of the mics. All right. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. We're up until 5:45, right? Huh? We have until 5:45, I think, right? Yeah, I think so. Okay, are there, I can't see because of the movement of people, if there's any questions. If you have any questions, if you could move up towards the front of the room. And if not, for the folks that are still sitting there, I've got a single question for each of the speakers. Gene, the optimal choice of graft for popliteal injuries?
Greater saphenous vein.
Okay. Any role ever for PTFE?
No.
Okay, and what about ligation of the popliteal vein? If you ligate that vein, is there anything that we need to, I mean, there's a ton of myth, maybe not myth, experience anecdotally about ligation of the vein. Thoughts on that?
Well, optimally, I think the vein should be reconstructed. And even in situations where there is extensive injury, if it's been a prolonged ischemic event, we often will place Gore-Tex in the vein with the understanding that in 3 to 5 days it'll clot, but at least it allows for that venous affluent.
That's not true. That just isn't true. If you put in externally supported large PTFE grafts and study them at 10 days, 30 days, 60 days, and I don't have a lot of data on the popliteal, but if you put them in the femoral, you'd be shocked how long they'll stay open. I agree with Gene that they probably all eventually clot. The advantage of these temporary plastic grafts in the venous system is it stops any distal soft tissue bleeding from the fasciotomy, decompresses the whole area of the wound, and allows your arterial graft, if you have arterial and venous together, to have better flow, at least in the first couple hours. So I don't think they'll clot that quickly, Gene, if you got rings on them.
Dr. Maddox, sounds like, do you have a comment on that?
In exposing the popliteal vessels, occasionally, probably more common than admitted, the saphenous vein will be injured going in. If that occurs and you have a popliteal venous injury, do repair it or repair the saphenous, because at that point you have ligated all outflow. But this is a teaching point to all residents. Be careful going in. Don't go in too fast. Don't cut the saphenous in half.
Dimitri, Dr. DeGiannis, comments on
that? I would never repair a complex venous injury at the popliteal area. And there is good evidence that ligation is perfectly fine and it does not increase the risk of compartment syndrome, published by Rao Aivaturi.
I'm glad we came to a consensus on that topic. So, all right, it sounds like we need to do another study. Dimitri, any tips for a bifurcation injury? So you've got some aorta and it comes across the bifurcation. What would you tell everybody for an injury like that?
Just know your anatomy very well. Most of the residents, even senior residents, do not know the anatomy well. If you know the anatomy, it just it's fine. It's like any other vascular injury. There's no complexity in repairing them.
And Dr. Feliciano, perioperative anticoagulation for these carotid injuries. What do you do as far as intraoperative heparin use? And then postoperatively, should they be on some sort of platelet inhibitor? What's your practice usually?
If you do them acutely, you probably don't need to heparinize. But honestly, if I'm going to do a segmental resection and either do an end-to-end or graft, I do the regional heparin like I do peripherally, 50 units of unfractionated heparin per ml. Once I get some good black back bleeding, got the clot out, I'll shoot 20 cc's up. If you do it 20 mls in each direction, it's 2,000 units. It's sort of mini heparinization to make me feel better. But as Ken said, there are no data that if you fix the carotids in less than 30 minutes, that you're ever going to have a stroke. And most people, particularly if you have good back bleeding, don't need to measure pressures. Just look at what your back bleeding is.
Okay, perfect. And I've got one more question for Dr. Maddox, but I'd actually like to hear right down the row, starting with Dr. DeGiannis. Like, the use of stenting for these vessels, like the innominate subclavian, is that something that you do at your center, yes or no? And if you do, what would be the indications for stenting the innominate or the subclavian?
Well, we don't do it. Most of the times we don't do it. We've done very few. But the thing is that if you have a stable patient with a pseudoaneurysm, this is a good case to put a stent. You avoid to open up the chest, because we all know you avoid that, but we open up the chest and sometimes hell breaks loose.
We just move down the line?
Yeah, for penetrating trauma, if the patient is unstable, and they are usually unstable, there is only one approach, open. Blunt trauma or small penetrating false aneurysm, stenting.
I think endovascular stents have two clear-cut places in trauma, ruptures, blunt ruptures, the descending aorta, and the subclavian, because it's a pain in the neck to access, as you nicely described. I will remind the audience, though, we have no, and I mean no, long-term data on these patients who are kids who are getting smaller stents in the distal subclavian near the joint and things like that. We have reasonable data on stents in the carotid from Gene's group, that the newer stents have patency. But just remember, the aortic stents is a classic example. We have no long-term follow-up. I'm still waiting for that paper from Stanford to tell us, you know, all these years later, what happened to all the patients they grafted in the beginning. So we don't know what's going to happen when you put all these foreign bodies in these young kids' arteries as they develop atherosclerosis. But I'll go back to my original statement. I think it's great in the subclavian if it's not bleeding actively.
Don't poke a skunk. There is no data. And I think we have shunted one vertebral in a patient that had no circle of Willis. And we only did that while we got a stent in. I showed you the x-ray of that one. Other than that one, we have not in branch vessels done any stenting, except in the areas Dr. Feliciano mentioned. Iliac. Did you mention iliac? Yeah, we stent iliacs, probably more common than any other location.
Can I just add one other thing?
Of course.
In patients in whom you have an associated traumatic brain injury and you put that stent in, you know, you got to catch 22 because then they want you, the stent guys want you to anticoagulate them. So I think just think ahead a little bit about the kind of patient you have, whether they have associated injuries in the abdomen, which might bleed post-op, like a spleen or a liver, or whether they have a traumatic brain injury. You can't do it then.
Absolutely. And Gene, anything to add on the stenting?
Well, anything I'd add is caution with a transected subclavian artery. I have seen several case presentations at surgical meetings in which a transected subclavian, particularly left proximal, led to intrathoracic uncontrolled hemorrhage and mortality. So I think we've got to be careful. I'm certainly enthusiastic about the stenting, and clearly with a left subclavian, that's challenging to access. It's appealing, but for transected subclavian arteries, it can be life-threatening.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I change the topic completely?
Of course.
So I love Dr. Dimitriadis, and I've learned a lot from him. But he whipped out that PTFE graft in the iliac artery and said, you know, there's poop all over, and you just put it in there. I just want to remind the audience, I've been doing this for 40 years, and so far I've had four patients come back who have blown out their iliac artery graft, whether it was a saphenous or PTFE. There is no cover down in the pelvis after you do all this exposure. So if you feel the need to put a graft in a heavily contaminated field, two things. You're going to get pelvic cellulitis post-op, if not an abscess. You've got to wrap the graft. You've got to mobilize the pedicle of omentum and do a 360 wrap of your whole graft. Otherwise, I'm going to tell you, some of these patients are going to blow. And the fifth one I'm aware of is when I was chief of surgery at Grady, and the patient died on the 21st day, a 21-year-old woman whose graft just exploded from pelvic infection. So I have no problem putting the graft in, but I will tell you, if you have a lot of contamination, at the least, cover this graft, and not just with peritoneum. It takes a little bit of time to get a long pedicle of viable omentum and circumferentially wrap it as if you were doing a spiral vein graft. I'm curious if Dimitri will respond.
I agree with you 100%, and I quote very often your paper, Dr. Mattox, about 250 patients, PTFE grafts. I agree, you need to wrap it. You don't mention more peritoneum. I stress it, but you are not listening.
All right, we've got time for three quick questions. Let's do front mic, then rear mic, and then Patty Byers can finish us off. So front mic, please.
Yeah, Asad Taha from Lehi Clinic. I want to ask the panel, what's their preference for the shunts? What shunt they prefer and the technique? Is it the short direct shunt or the loop?
Use what you've got, even suction tubing if you don't have anything else. But the pre-prepared carotid shunts work very fine, and they usually come in a package, and you can size them to the injury, to the size of the vessel you use. But use a nasogastric tube if necessary.
The two companies that make the shunts we use, the Pruitt Inahara, which is now the Pruitt F3, is a bigger size than the classic Pruitt Inahara. And the Argyles have also gone up one more French size. So most of us use the Argyle, but as Ken says, you can use anything. You can use large bore IV tubing. We use chest tubes in the femoral vein. Anything that's plastic, cut it as short as possible. You usually don't have to anticoagulate if it's a really wide bore shunt. But the commercial shunts that are now available, probably because of all the interest in shunting, are now a French size higher at two of the companies, which makes it much better.
And you don't need to heparinize the shunts if they are commercial ones? Yeah, okay.
Well, I think that the question's a little more complex than that, because I don't think the Argyle is routine for shunting. It depends on whether it's a bridge or you're a damage control. If it's a bridge and you have, for example, a threatened lower leg, a Pruitt Inahara is nice because a third limb in which you can infuse TPA and heparin during your repair and gain reconstruction that way. If it's something which you could do damage control, then I agree a short shunt would be nice. But for a bridging step and a reconstruction, I would argue the Pruitt shunt is preferred.
But I will tell you, if you have a good size arterial shunt and not one of these crazy little string things that some people put in, and your arterial shunt occludes in the perioperative period, you've got a problem with venous outflow. Either you have chosen to ligate the vein or you have missed the vein distally, the thrombose. Because these shunts, I have one patient in the literature who had a shunt for like 10 or 12 days. Big argyle, axillary artery, the guy had arrested, he was renal failure, respiratory failure. They'll stay open, but when they clot, either you've screwed up putting it in or you have no venous outflow. Something's wrong.
Dimitri, final comment? You know,
carotid arteries are unforgiving for shunts. Be very cautious. Do not put liberally shunts in the carotid artery. If they thrombose, very often it means stroke. In these cases, I would prefer to put a T-shaped shunt and use continuous heparin infusion and try to go back as early as possible. If there is thrombosis in the iliac artery, it's not a catastrophe. If there is a thrombosis in the carotid artery, it's catastrophe.
All right, can we move to the rear mic?
Yeah, hi, Zach Bauman here from University of Nebraska. With the increase in the use of TVAR now for thoracic transections, a lot of them occurring at the distal aortic arch, if you get a phone call from the vascular surgeon that the patient now is in cardiac arrest and you got to run into the hybrid suite, where would you make your exposure? Would you do a median sternotomy or a left thoracotomy, or how would you kind of approach that patient?
I would use an anterior lateral thoracotomy. I would get the biggest chest tube I have, and I would put it in the thoracic aorta as a temporary shunt. If they're pumping on the heart, I might cut the posterior pericardium. It's closer to the aorta, and slide the graft up and then wrap it with umbilical tape or something. Do what you must do and use the biggest tube you got.
And the best for last, Patty?
I'm so glad you saved me for last, because I don't have a question, okay? I don't have a question. So I have a comment, okay? I just want, this is not for us, this is for the young people in the audience. I just want to thank you all for keeping it real. I mean, this presentation was awesome. It was no kind of theoretical stuff. You guys kept it real. I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you guys very much. Thank you.
A message I would like to leave you is that vascular trauma must be owned by the trauma surgeon. Increasingly, both general surgeons, vascular surgeons, military surgeons are not trained to do the stuff you saw this afternoon. And if anybody is going to save these patients, it's the general surgeon who's taking trauma call.
Thank you very much, guys. Fantastic. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.